Welcome to the 30th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Tonight, we have Dr. Joel Furman. He is a family medicine practitioner. He has written numerous books, including Eat to Live, Super Immunity, End of Dieting, The End of Diabetes, and the Eat to Live Cookbook. Dr. Furman has been practicing nutritional medicine essentially since he became a physician. He has an interesting sports background in that he was a U.S. world figure skating champion. He competed in Paris with his sister, and they won second place in the 1973 World Figure Skating Championship. He then went to medical school and did his residency at UPenn, knowing all the time that he wanted to practice nutritional medicine. You'll hear some of his story as the interview goes along. Dr. Furman brings some interesting perspectives with regards to grains and nuts and seeds that's a little different from Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Campbell's perspective. I think they both have extremely good points, and certainly both have a lot of years of experience backing up their views. So I'll let you listen to the interview and come up with your own conclusions. We'll also try to tie things up at the end and kind of go over the differences, but mainly the similarities, because for the most part, everyone is practicing a plant-based, whole foods way of eating. There's a few nuances in each of the authors' perspectives. So enjoy Dr. Joel Furman's perspective and his interview. Welcome, Dr. Furman. It's a pleasure to have you on my podcast. I'm a huge follower. I think I own most of your books, Eat to Live, Super Immunity, End of Dieting, The End of Diabetes. I don't have your cookbook, but I've looked at some of your other recipes. They're all wonderful books. You've had great success over the years. I would love to talk to you about the books and, you know, your success. But first, tell me, the thing that intrigued me right up front was that you are actually United States World Figure Skating Champion. So is that how your athletic career started, I guess, or?
Well, thanks. Well, when I was a teenager and a child, I was busy as a competitive figure skater. And I was second in the United States in pair skating with my sister in 1973. So it's, you know, the early 1970s. That's, you know, a long time ago. But, yep, I was like, working out and skating and training and, you know, doing all that stuff before I went to college and all through college, you know.
And nutrition started back then. I believe you had an injury and you did a fast. And tell me a little bit about that progression and then your progression into plant-based eating, so to speak, or your progression or love into nutrition.
Well, yeah, you know, I was a serious competitive athlete. We always tried to watch our diet for better athletic performance and not to get sick, too. You know, even now today, I'm advising athletes on how to improve their performance and keep themselves so they don't get sick as frequently and they can keep training, and, you know, through super immunity and super nutrition. I was into that stuff when I was young. But my father, what initially got us started, I think, was my father was overweight and sickly. And I can remember, you know, he could hardly sit up straight. You know, his back was hurting him. We drove in the back of a station wagon with him lying flat from doctor to doctor. He had a whole bunch of problems. And so we started reading in the family nutritional books and health books for him. And he got well, lost about, you know, 50 pounds, and he got in better health. And I started reading a lot of books on nutrition when I was still a teenager and still competing. So that was all happening at the same time. Through the natural health movement in my, you know, in my teenage years and early 20s, I witnessed a lot of people able to rejuvenate and restore themselves back to good health again by a significant or radical dietary change back then in the 1960s, you know, and the early 1970s. And I was very enthusiastic about this and became interested in nutrition very young. And I was actually through my skating career, and then right after, when I was coaching skating and then working my father's shoe business, I felt that, you know, what I really would like to do for my life is go back to medical school. and pursue a career in as a physician specializing in nutrition. And I did that, and you know, actually, it's funny because I was at my sister's graduation party from college, and I met a woman who was going to go to medical school, had applied, and you know, and then I started telling her how, you know, doctors just give drugs, and they, you know, it's not like we have a real core, the real problem with disease is the way people are eating. And she said, why don't you go to medical school and change things from the inside out? You know, so the point is, that encouraged me to like go back and redouble my efforts to like leave the business and go back to school full time. I went to the Columbia postgraduate pre-med program after I had graduated from college a few years earlier, and then accelerated like the coursework I needed, and then went back to medical school and did that. And I eventually married that woman at the party, who I met at the, you know, so she became my wife, and we, you know, so, but the point is, so in other words, I didn't develop this interest in nutrition as a physician. It was the main reason why I decided to go back to medical school.
Yeah, that's very different from, you know, a lot of people. So, I mean, obviously through medical school, it must have been somewhat frustrating because you weren't getting a lot of, you get the whys, but you're certainly not getting a lot of nutritional education. And so you came out, and I assume you did a traditional family practice residency?
Yes, that's correct. I went to medical school, and when I went to Penn, you know, I was chairman of the Nutritional Education Committee. I did a lot of, I did research there. I actually, did have a lot of discussions at school about the lack of nutrition in medical education. And, you know, it was interesting. And had a lot of good, a lot of good, interesting intellectual discussions, and met a lot of people into the nutritional field. And when I came out and did a family practice residency, even through that residency, I was still advocating my nutritional information and stuff. So, you know, I've been a family physician now for 25 years, board-certified family physician for 25 years, and I've been practicing nutritional medicine for many, many years. And I've taken, you could say, at the beginning, you know, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I was still getting great results with my patients and motivating people and doing the same thing I'm doing now, but I wasn't affecting as many people. Because I hadn't written books, and I hadn't, and people, you know, saw you as being a little bit of this crazy doctor down the road, you know, was into nutrition. But nowadays, with the advent of the internet and exposure on television and writing books, I have, you know, affected millions of people across America. It's like I never dreamed I'd be able to have a positive effect on so many people. It's just been a tremendous blessing that I've been able to. Had this opportunity, and now with pursuing research studies in this field that are going to affect more the medical profession, I'm really super excited about what is, you know, how the trajectory and how this is, how society is finally becoming more, you know, accepting and seeing all the tragedy that befalls people that is needless, the needless heart attacks, the needless strokes, the needless dementia, the needless cancers that people have been, you know, killing themselves with food, and we have to recognize, we have to give people the opportunity to control their health destiny, because the facts are is that we've made tremendous advances in nutritional science, and we have food is the most powerful medicine, and we can have, instead of the average lifespan being in the late 70s, the average lifespan can be in the late 90s. You know, we have the ability to live 20 years longer in great health, and it's great and fun to take advantage of staying young and physically fit and being able to be healthy and having ourselves age slower. It's just a wonderful blessing that I'm grateful to have the opportunity to have more people coming on board, and so many people have told me they've dropped 50 pounds, they say, you know, their heart disease is gone, their diabetes is gone, their headaches are gone, they've recovered from lupus and psoriasis and arthritis, and it's just that seeing people transform their lives is just very exciting.
Now, your books, Eat to Live, Super Immunity, End of Dieting, The End of Diabetes, the premise of your nutritarian diet is plant-based, and plant-based in whole foods.
Well, I don't know what the word plant-based means, frankly.
Okay.
I mean, what does that mean, plant-based? I mean, the American diet or the standard American diet is plant-based too, you know, for that matter. I mean, it's 30% of calories from animal products and about 70% of calories from plants. So based, how would I say it? A nutritarian diet is a diet rich in nutrients. It's nutrient dense and plant rich, much more percent of plants than the average American's eating. The average American's eating 70% of calories from plants, but 50% of the calories Americans eat are processed plants, like Coca-Cola and white bread and sugar. Those come from plants, too. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I want to be really specific, and that a nutritarian diet is based on four basic premises. Number one, it should be rich in nutrients. And that's, you know, nutrient dense, and we know that foods, for example, we know that bread and pasta and sugar and all the, you know, oil are not nutrient rich. They're just four sources of calories. No big nutrient load in there like broccoli and tomatoes and berries. We want to eat foods that are, we want to focus on the nutrient dense foods that have anti-cancer phytochemicals and antioxidants in them, because that extends human lifespan. Number two, the second principle, we want, I call it CNA, or comprehensive nutrient adequacy, which just means that the diet has to be complete across the board, would contain all the nutrients humans need. In other words, we can't just have foods that are high in nutrients. We could be missing some nutrients that are outliers. We have to get sure we have zinc and vitamin D and omega-3. We have to get everything humans need. Number three, the diet has to be hormonally favorable, and that's very important. We can't have too many high glycemic carbohydrates like white rice, sugar, white potato, white bread. You know, I always say the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead. But the point is that these high glycemic carbohydrates can promote obesity and diabetes and heart disease and even cancer. The other part of being hormonally favorable is too much animal protein, because animal products, and especially animal protein, drives up a hormone called IGF-1, which promotes growth and cellular replication and is a cancer promoter and promotes angiogenesis in excess. And angiogenesis means is hormonally promoting the growth of new blood vessels that feed fat and feed tumor growth and even feed the spread of cancer. That we want that natural foods like greens and berries and mushrooms have anti-angiogenesis effects. They don't let fat store. They interfere with fat storage. They interfere with tissue growth as an adult and the development of tumors. And sugar and steroids and other, you know, and high glycemic carbohydrates and high and animal products in general. Too many animal products in the diet. As that goes up, you get more diabetes and more heart disease and more cancer. And we're learning that one of the mechanisms involved is driving up this hormone that promotes cellular replication called IGF-1 or insulin-like growth factor 1.
Do you think in your book?
And I just want to say the fourth principle is avoiding toxins and carcinogens and noxious agents in foods. So basically what I'm saying is that there are three basic, we could say, nutritional guidelines that all nutritional scientists in the world have to agree on today. Number one, we have to eat more fruits and vegetables and less processed foods. And number two, we have to eat less animal products, not more. And number three, we have to avoid these high glycemic carbohydrates and too much refined foods that are lacking in nutrients, because that can promote disease too. So, you know, so we're designing a diet style to be maximally lifespan promoting.
So when someone comes to your office, the diabetic hypertensive patient, you know, that may have had a stent, do they come to see you as general practice now, or are you just so well known for nutrition that people come already wanting to help have your expertise in nutrition?
You know, I think most of my career in the last 25 years as a family doctor, people knew what they were getting when they came to see me. They know that they were getting, you know, they had a serious illness, but they would get primarily a nutritional approach. They weren't going to get the standard approach where you just hand them medications or set them up for surgeries. And, you know, most of the time they would come to see me with a stent was recommended to them, and I'd say, give me 3 months. You're stable, you're not having unstable angina, you're not in a position, give me 3 months and you go back to the cardiologist. If you follow my recommendations, you will not need that stent. You know, you will not need that bypass surgery. And I showed people that within 3 months period, I can get rid of their angina. I could have them drop 40 pounds. I can lower their blood pressure 25 points. I can get them, you know. And you know, what's funny now is I just did a study where I think I had like 400 people in the survey where their average systolic drop was about 27, 28 points in systolic blood pressure without medications, which is tremendous. You know, medications, as you know, only lower blood pressure about 10 points, you know, for one dose of medication. But we're talking here about that almost all these patients come off their high blood pressure medications. They can come off their cholesterol-lowering drugs. They can come off their, you know, their chest pains go away. We open up the aorta. Nutrition is powerfully more effective than stents. Because as you know, you put a stent in there, and now you've got to stay on, you know, aspirin, Plavix. You've got to have an increased risk of having a clot. And then you're on these clot busts, these blood thinners that increases your risk of hemorrhagic stroke and GI bleed. So you know you're not getting something. You're not getting something for nothing, and you're not treating all the other areas of the heart, a vulnerable plaque in your heart that's not as outside of where the stent ends. You still got a lot of disease that's not being addressed in that area. You know as a cardiologist that it's much better if people could adopt their health, could stay, get well, and avoid the need for medical care and medical procedures.
No, I even think cardiologists are recognized that the era of stents, especially drug-eluting stents, are a nightmare with Plavix therapy and all the complications associated with them. It's just a nightmare. So, but you also get, we also hear, on TV and everything that, the family practitioner can't make a living doing this because you got to see 30 people a day.
Yeah, it's hard for conventional physicians to do this. If I was going to do it all over again, and I do work with doctors now, I tell them, have groups in the office, like set up groups where people come, all the diabetics come on Wednesday night, and all on Thursday nights, you have all the people with autoimmune disease comes, and give lectures and give presentations in groups and reduce the amount of time, so you don't have to spend all the time explaining with the same story for 1 hour over and over again, and give people videos and books, and that's what you're doing. I think you're creating an informational channel for people, because a doctor has to be an educator, a motivator, a coach, it has to be an example of good health. And and obviously that's not what the medical profession does today. They're just running from patient to patient, writing prescriptions, predominantly anyway.
Yeah, that actually sounds like a very good idea. It would be nice if, a lot of practices worked that way. I know, I'm having the class in my office, but, I find myself over and over and, every room, and by the time the afternoon's, up, I'm almost hoarse from, because you try to get in as quick as you can.
Right, exactly.
So very interested. I loved all your books, but the super immunity is fantastic. I think that a lot of cancer treatment, cancer etiology, and people are starting to finally become aware that, we all have risks to cancers, but we all don't need to get cancer. And I think that's something that nutrition, certainly if people talked about nutrition and cancer, the quack word came up very quickly. But, now people are starting, some of the drugs are even dealt at improving immunity. And I just want to scream. And it's like, well, you can improve immunity through what you eat.
That's right. I make the radical statement, and people say, that's crazy, that we can wipe out 90% of the common cancers in America today. And they say, 90%? How can we get rid of 90% of breast cancer? Things like that. Well, I say, look, there are populations around the world right now, and there are populations that we can look at, 40, 50 years ago that had 90% less breast cancer than we had in America. And we saw how these populations adopted American way of eating, and their cancer rates skyrocketed and went up 500% in the last 25 years. And then we have, look at the studies on the food. People with high intake of, people who eat just 10 grams of mushrooms a day, a study showed that the breast cancer rate was reduced 64% just in the mushrooms alone. And the studies on flax seeds and breast cancer and green vegetables and breast cancer and berries and cancer. In other words, when we put all these, a portfolio of the superfoods together that have sort of documented powerful anti-cancer effects, and remove those things we know that are carcinogens in the diet, I'm claiming that cancer is not the inevitable consequence of aging. It's not from getting older, like people claim. It's not even predominantly genetic. And even with the people, so in other words, we do have control, tremendous control over this. It's just that people, are food addicted and they don't understand the science. They're not presented it. The doctors don't know it. It's still, you can consider it in its infancy because people aren't studying it, and the books out there are always 10 or 15 years behind the times. And my mission and desire is to have people. I can't force people to eat healthy. If they want to smoke cigarettes and have heart disease or eat unhealthy food and go to fast food restaurants and get depression and get all kinds of dementia when they get older, it's their choice. But at least they should be aware that they're making that choice. At least they should not smoke thinking smoking is okay. They should know they're going to pay a price. They should not eat conventional food and recognize that they should know that you don't have to have heart attacks. You can choose not to have a stroke. You can choose not to get demented. And we can choose not to get cancer. So we can really have a much better life and let people make those decisions to eat like other Americans with their eyes open, fully informed, and fully informed about the risks and lack of benefit of common medications like blood pressure medications, statins, and diabetic medication. You know, that people have an inflated viewpoint, and stents, for example, they have an inflated viewpoint of what doctors can do, and because of that, too, they don't put enough legitimate interest and effort to clean up their lifestyles.
So when the woman with breast cancer comes that's already been diagnosed, how do you counsel her?
Well, I tell her that, you know, I don't know for sure, you know, whether this, how should we say, this nutritarian diet, you know, it depends on, you know, what type of cancer, how old age she's at, how aggressive the cancer is, where she is. So I can't guarantee any kind of benefits, but I can give her lots of examples of case histories to show her what has happened with many of my patients, you know, and how that, for example, I have a patient who had ovarian cancer that spread to her lung, and she had a collapsed lung, and she was given like 6 months to live, and now it's 18 years later, and she's doing great, and she's got no cancer, and she's in great health. And, you know, is it likely that the diet had something to do with her beating ovarian cancer? Or did that one round of chemo she got, you know, back 15 years ago do it? But may have been, who knows? But, you know, but there aren't many other people who ate alive 18 years later after metastatic ovarian cancer spread to the whole body. You know, in other words, I can show one case after another. You know, even my sister-in-law who had breast cancer, following the diet style, when they went to remove the mass, they couldn't find any residual cancer cells. So, in other words, did the chemo that she had worked so great that it just knocked out all that's possible? But I have one case after another that in some of these cases used superior nutrition, you know, as an adjunctive therapy to more traditional therapy. Some did not, but the results have been overall, you know, kind of amazing. And, you know, I don't claim to be able to, it's not something I'm, what's the word, advocating relying on nutrition, because some cancers can actually, you know, they don't take a chance. Some cancers can kill you. But obviously, it's very, very underrepresented, under-understood, and underutilized as an adjunctive therapy with people with cancer. But certainly, to prevent cancer, we know it's tremendously powerful and naturally been well-studied.
Are you doing any of the study? Are any of your studies focused on people that already have cancer, or mainly on the prevention side of things?
Well, I'm starting a study with Harvard University shortly with diabetes and heart disease with a triple arm controlled trial, and that's going to go on. That's going to start in September. We're designing, you know, we're still working on it, so that's very exciting. I am working on a health study where we're enrolling thousands of women who eat G-bombs, you know, greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds, a high intake of cancer foods, and following their alcohol for many years. And a lot of those enrollees were people who have been diagnosed with cancer. So I'm looking to start that study, and we think we're going to be run through the university, the Northern Arizona University project out of that project. So I am looking to do a study like that, and we're going to be looking for oncologists and physicians to recommend their patients join the study arm who have cancer, and to follow them on how well they do over a 10-year period compared to, you know, historical controls. So yes, we are, you know, what should I say, the expectation and enthusiasm to start that study soon. We are working on developing that study as well.
That's fantastic. And, you know, for the patient, you know, I'm new to this, and the problems that I face when patients come to my office, I give them the talk, and, you know, and I, you know, pretty much give them your recommendations. You know, we want to eat a nutrient-rich diet, vegetables, the G-bombs, the whole nine yards. And when people fail, it's usually for two reasons. It's usually the grains, pastas, and or, you know, some sort of fat intake, whether it be processed oils. I guess I have to ask you the question, are there certain patients, you know, I have, like, it seems like my diabetic patients really want to fall into refined flours. And I don't know that any refined flour is good in these people, whether it's millet or, you know, some sort of gluten-free or whole wheat. I just don't think they can control it. It seems to me that, you know, they it's hard to get them to eat, you know, a lot of vegetables and a pasta once in a while, or a grain that once in a while. So I try to, I'm backing off. And the other thing is, you know, the control of the nut intake, you know, you refer to 1 ounce a day, correct?
No, I don't, you know, I want people to have at least 1 ounce a day.
At least 1 ounce
a day. Not a maximum of 1 ounce a day. It depends on the person, their size, what kind of calories they need, you know what I mean? And the substitution of nutrients. In other words, as you eat more nuts and less carbohydrate in your diet, you know, especially high glycemic carbohydrates, you have better glycemic control, you know, low and we've helped acceleration of the reversal of heart disease, actually. So I want them to eat maybe somewhere between 1 and 3 ounces of nuts a day, maybe, you know, maybe 3 ounces for a guy and 1.5 ounces for a woman, or 2 ounces for a woman and 3.5 ounces for a guy, somewhere in that range. But I want to eat at least 1 ounce a day of nuts, because they're dramatically affected to longer lifespan and prevention against cancer and cardiovascular mortality in later life. Not eating them is really, you know, the inclusion of nuts and seeds extends life span from a lot of different various mechanisms. But we don't want people snacking on nuts and seeds. We want them eating, making them as dressing, saucings, and dips to increase their enjoyment of eating vegetables and salads, to eating those, you know, part of their, you know, so they can't just sit down with a bag of nuts in front of the TV set and feel, eat a thousand, see, eat 1,000 or 2,000 calories. There are 175 to 190 calories an ounce. That's why we're talking about ounces here. Whereas when we're talking about mushrooms and onions and berries and greens, they're so low in calories, people can eat as much as they want. There's a few foods that are more calorically dense, so we have to make sure that people eat them, but not eat huge amounts of them. That's where the nuts and seeds fall into the category. But I think the major problem is, it's the reason why people don't stick with it, is they're not completely educated. They don't get the motivation and support they need. They haven't really accepted the fact that this way of eating can taste as good and be as pleasurable as the present diet. So they think they're giving something up, and they don't realize it takes a few months, 3 to 6 months, to change over your taste buds, to learn the recipes, to actually, you know, to... and also, you know, there are bean pastas and all of the other things that contain the healthy desserts, and there's even, we can make ice cream out of natural that tastes great, and without making it as sweet as regular ice cream, out of bananas and, you know, and fruit and some nuts mixed in, and vanilla and cocoa powder. We can make all kinds of healthy things for them that taste great. It's just a matter of allowing time for their taste buds to get reacclimated. Because I find through the immersion programs we do, the vacations we do, the food, we have all kinds of, you know, a lot of support for people to do this, that when we give people the right kind of information, the right kind of supportive services, they do it. Most people do it if they learn it thoroughly and are given the information they need to make it work for themselves.
And so just to reiterate, because I want to drive this home, because I think it's, for my patients, it seems to be a source of confusion. You use a lot of the nuts to make the dressing. So could they be cashews, or do you stick with mainly walnuts and almonds and things like that?
I want a good portion of the nut intake. Let's say a third to a half their nut. I'd like them to eat some walnuts, some flax seeds or hemp seeds or chia seeds. I want them to eat some of those omega-3 fats every day, because they contain lignans that protect against prostate and breast cancer. Now, if they eat some of those walnuts and flax seeds and chia seeds or hemp seeds, you know, every day, then they can have the other two-thirds of the nut intake can be from any nut they want. Cashew, pecans, pistachio, almonds. But I want them to at least try to eat the walnuts and the flax because of their protective and health benefits. You follow me?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And your green intake, do you follow the greens as far as... I know that this, you know, it's very nutrient-dense. And do you recommend that highly, or do you let people choose among, you know, the various vegetables?
No, I want people to have two types of... I want them to choose various vegetables, yeah, but I want them to have a salad every day, at least one salad a day. So one meal is the main dish, a large, big salad. And that salad should have a healthy nut-based dressing on it. Maybe, you know, it could be tomato sauce with with balsamic vinegar and almonds blended in, and sunflower seeds in there with a little bit of raisin and a little bit of Golas roasted garlic. In other words, a healthy dressing, a big salad with some maybe red onion and tomato and shredded cabbage or on top, you know, some kind of really healthy salad once a day to get those raw vegetables in. And then once at another time, at a different meal maybe, you should have a big portion of lightly steamed greens or wok vegetables like broccoli and snow pea pods or cabbage or string beans or artichokes or asparagus or some kind of green. So I do want people to eat both the raw and the cooked green vegetables every day. And then they can still have other vegetables too, you know, stewed tomatoes, roasted peppers, you know, butternut squash, all kinds of vegetables. I want them to eat this one huge serving a day of salad, no matter what. That's a mantra. I want people to stop what they're doing, get a magic marker, put a big sign in the refrigerator that says the salad is the main dish, put it on your refrigerator, and have at least one main dish salad a day. That's the most important thing people can do.
I liked your recommendation, and I'm actually going to adopt it in my wellness class of doing the business plan for their program themselves, to really plan out their menus and the grocery list and when they're going to cook and what they're going to cook and what time, you know, timing things, and get a good idea laid out in front of them. I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, because people fail if they don't plan. They got to plan to plan, or they're going to fail. Because it's not, you know, do the soup on the weekend, make a big pot of soup with the beans in it, have it, put it out into 6 to 8 different containers for the whole week for your lunches, you know, make the salad dressing on Saturday and Wednesday nights, when you're going to shop, when you're going to exercise, plan out your week, who's going to help you do it, whether you're going to have any help or you can do it yourself. You got to plan this out, because you can't be stuck there out in the environment with no healthy food to eat, because you're going to want to go back to eating. So you got to make some healthy food, you got to make it taste great, and you got to have it available for you when you, you know, so you can make it easy for yourself. Has to be planned. And that's what we help people do. We help them how to figure out the business plan to make this work for them, to make it taste delicious, and to realize they don't have to give up their enjoyment in food to be healthy. That's a myth.
Mixed households and families. How do you know you have a, so you have the 40-year-old that now comes in with hypertension to see you, and they're on board, and he's like, well, I've got 3 kids, and so what's your recommendation, your motivation for those people?
Well, you know, I'm always, it's part of it is good psychology. We want people of all ages to recognize they shouldn't be smoking cigarettes, snorting cocaine, and eating junk food. Junk food and commercially baked goods are linked to depression, poor performance in school, aggressive behavior, put people in prisons. I mean, we're talking about the American diet is seriously lacking and dangerous. And you want your kids eating that way, and you know, it's crazy the way people are eating in society today. You have to be insane or really misinformed to be eating like other Americans are eating. We have to change everybody. And I'll sit down there with the kids and I'll say, look, you know, even when they bring the child in with attention deficit disorder or with asthma or some for headaches or some, you know, I've had all kinds of taking care of children with all kinds of problems and solve them with nutrition, but I'll sit down with that kid and I'll say, you know, I need your help because your parents have been raised in this environment of food. Everybody's a food addict, and we've developed a food system that's killing people. I know you love your father, but he's got these problems that could, you know, love your mother, but you know, if you have a parent who smokes cigarettes, you've got to work to have that parent quit. If you have a parent that's addicted to high glycemic carbohydrates, who can't stop eating donuts, or who has ice cream in their freezer, you've got to get that food out of the house and not make your parents be tempted. And if you want to, you got to make them eat their vegetables. So I enlist the kid. I don't focus on the kid as much, but I focus on enlisting them as my partner in making sure the parent eats healthfully. And that's work, because the kid then understands the concepts and he starts to make sure the parent eats healthfully and becomes my ally in getting their mother or father to get on board. And I, you know, so and then the secondary thing is that the whole family sits down and realizes the value of this for everybody, you know, and the kid being, and the kid's just like, and it works. You know, children do, when they are taught the science and they learn that acne and all these medical problems and headaches and poor performance and obesity and diabetes and heart attacks and strokes don't have to happen, and it's all from the people's food they're eating, they get pleasure in learning how to make healthy ice creams and healthy desserts and healthy meals, and you involve them in the cooking, and they understand this. They're not, you know, they have an intellect and can figure it out. They're more compliant than people give them credit for once they understand the concepts here, you know.
Yeah, I think that's probably an excellent advantage to be able to get the kid involved. What about the wife, though? You know, you're saying, okay, so the guy's 250 pounds and she doesn't really, or, you know, or he doesn't really want, or he does the cooking and, you know, she wants to change. How do you get both you know, spouses on board?
Well, you know, it boils down to information. You know, I've had a lot of these getaways. We do like a week vacation with people, and I just finished last week was an immersion program for Whole Foods Market, which means they took the most overweight and sickly employees and they put them in a hotel. We run this program for a week, and I just go, haven't read my book. They're just volunteering to, you know, that they were overweight and our medications. Do we want to reduce healthcare costs? And they're throwing the hotel with me. And the first couple of days, they're saying, "Wow, what is this, a cult? I can't eat like this. I can't eat all these healthy foods. Where's my burgers? Where's my meat? Where's my cheese? Where's my salt? Where's the oil? Where's my fried foods?" You're going crazy, you know, the first couple of days. And one guy, but by the end of the week, they're feeling so much better. They dropped 10 pounds. They realize that they're, even in the first week, they're starting to enjoy the taste more, and they're starting to learn how to cook the recipes with the cooking classes, and realizing they can make a healthy food that tastes great. And they start to, by the end of the week, they're like, "Wow, this is incredible." And they're going home and saying, "I can do this," and they're changing. They're going home and throwing out the junk food in the house. And they're, you know, I think they have these immersions where the husband accompanies the wife, and he's just going there for the golf or for the tennis. You know, he's just going there to accompany the wife on the vacation, but she's getting trained. By the time he sits through the lectures and learns all the information, he realizes it's a no-brainer. You know, what am I going to commit suicide? Why should I risk getting demented or running for a bus and have a heart attack? Or why should I throw my life away over a few mouthfuls of food that I eat every day? Like, when this healthy stuff tastes just as good, you know, and it's just a matter of learning. So I think that it's difficult, but it's difficult because people are so uninformed. They're so misinformed. They're so miseducated. They're so confused with all the nonsense they've heard and all the competing dietary theories out there. But when they really go over the science with them, and they really, and I can get them to, like, I always say, you know, I'm making you a PhD. I'm giving you a PhD class in nutrition here. I want you to graduate this week. But once they got the knowledge, it's hard for them to go back and live the way other Americans do.
Yeah, so it's again, we're back to intensive education that you can't necessarily do in an office visit. So it's got.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and sometimes people can read a book and do it, be very successful, and sometimes people can come to a program and be very successful. But the most success is people who do both, who study the book, and also gets exposure to other people, and or the, like you're saying, the classes, the explanations, the discussions, the communications. They communicate and they read the book. And then they get the most. So if a person devotes themselves to learning this information, they do it and they enjoy it and it works. It's just that some people just don't do well with just, they feel they're too left alone with a book. But if they could really study the book, they could probably get all the information they needed. But, you know, people have different needs and need different handholding and degrees of support. And so I've been trying to give them as much support as I can in developing services that can help people do this easier and make sure that they, you know, increase the probability of them being compliant and wanting to eat this way, wanting to live this way, and enjoying it. The more knowledge we give them, the more structure, the more they, you know, can benefit from all the, how should I say, 25 years of experience in doing this, then it increases the probability they're going to enjoy it and do it for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I still have, you know, I have a fair amount of patients that still, I guess, you know, like you say, there's so much conflicting information out there, and they want to try to, you know, it's like, I can control this, like an alcoholic can control their drinks, you know. So if they fast all day long and then they eat at night, that's their attempt. I can eat what I want if I can just not eat all day long. That's one thing that I'll run into. And of course, you know what happens? They eat all night long of all the bad things, or they grab the bag of chips on the way home, you know, at the service station.
Right, it almost never works. It's like telling an alcoholic to solve the problem by putting their alcohol in smaller cups. Telling people to, you know, or don't drink as frequently, then you want to binge drink more. You know, it doesn't work. You can't, it's hard to cut back on something that's so addicting, that has so many addictive triggers for people. They just got to get the junk out of their diet. And they got, you know, and over time, you know, you look at it as being disgusting. And how did they ever put that in your body? And they feel so much better, and they, you know, and they. But in any case, I hear you. I agree. It's there. There's so much craziness out there, And people are always looking for a way that they can, you know, they can have their cake and eat it too. They, you know, they want to still, you know, I'll quit smoking in the future, or I'll, you know, I'll change my diet down the road, or I'll still have this on the weekends. And, you know, and that could work for some people. There are some people who can control their amount of unhealthy foods they eat to a small amount and eat enough healthy stuff and still be very healthy. But there's so many people who that doesn't work for as well. So you have to adjust the recommendations to those, to some people who have, where if they go off their diet, it leads to a complete binge, and they're off it for, they're on a binge for days or weeks. You know what I mean? They, so so there's something to be said for a certain type of person for complete abstinence or immersion in the nutritarian program, where they're on board and they really see they got to do this and put a, you know, 20 consecutive days in a row doing this to retrain their taste, to stop the addictive drive to go back and eat sweets and eat junk. And then things get easier once you put those 3 weeks in. You know, so yeah, it's like the same thing when you quit smoking. You got to get off the cigarettes for, you know, for a period of time, and then eventually the craving diminishes. The same thing with food. So a lot of times people have to jump in with both feet.
Yes, I believe in one of your books. I think it's the diabetes books, Moderation is Failure.
Moderation is, yeah, that's right. It's usually on the road to... It's more like giving excuses, and I'm always saying that there's, you know, there's an excuse is no excuse. People always, because the part of the mind that's addicted, the primitive part of the mind, always can come up with a rationalization, whether it's how delusional it may be as to why it's not the right time to go on, not the right time to eat healthy, or just a little bit's going to be okay, or my social situation, my kids won't do it, the travel, it's too much stress in my life. That, you know, the addictive part of the mind can always come up with an excuse to try to maintain the addiction. And you got to say an excuse, you know, you can't, an excuse is not an excuse. It's like when you get married. You know, they don't say, you know, you're going to give this marriage a try, and the first difficulty, you know, you're going to run the other way. You make a commitment, and this, when you're trying to get rid of it, and food is so powerfully addicting, especially sugar, salt, and oil. You know, this SOS, we call it. The sugar and the oil and the high caloric concentrated calories are so addictive, they trigger dopamine in the brain, and people are fighting not to give it up, and they really got to diminish the dopamine hit by getting off it for a few weeks in order to not have that tremendous attraction for it. And so people have to make a firm commitment. No matter how bad you're going to feel, no matter what the temptation is going to happen, no matter what happens, don't go back to smoking, don't go back to drinking, don't go back to eating sugar and, you know, and oils on your diet right now. We got to get you off those concentrated calories, and then you can start to enjoy, and you won't miss it so much once you're away for a while, you know?
Is it possible to eat out on this?
Oh, yeah, you know, you could, yeah, once you really understand what a nutritarian diet is and how to prepare, you can, there are even, you know, you can always go to a healthier restaurant, but anyway, all restaurants have salads and vegetables. You just got to, you know, say, you know, you just got to ask the waiter to design what you want. So the first step is to learn it. Then you can apply it to almost every situation you're encountering, including restaurants, parties, you know, and you just, and the word nutritarian, it means a person who's eating a diet rich in nutrients. You know, they realize it's a nutritarian is a person who recognizes that what they eat matters, and what you put in your mouth makes your body and builds and creates the future, your future health. So you're creating and building your future, and you're either eating yourself into medical problems or you're eating yourself out of medical problems, and you have that option. And you don't, you know, and what you put in gives you, you know, builds the house that you wind up with. You know, the idea that that health is like luck or genetics is really just a myth that people like to use to justify and to rationalize why they're so sick.
I think that the nutritarian way of thinking and the way of eating is especially important when you look at athletes. And I'm also an endurance athlete, triathlons, marathons, and I'm also often frustrated when you go to a race, an event, and, you know, you have more and more people are running half marathons, and, of course, a lot of people are overweight, and you finish the race, and they have bagels and donuts and pizza, and, you know, it's like, what are you doing?
Did you know that they did study on these marathon runners and found they had a higher rate of heart disease than people who were not marathon runners, than people who exercised less? It was me, you know. I think you're right. It's that because they're burning up so many calories, they think that gives it a license to eat more junk food and less healthy food, and they pay a price for that. It's like you can eat more food, but you're putting more bad food in your body, and you get a more bad outcome. So being exercising a lot and being thinner does not give you a license to eat everything and to think you're not going to get problems. You are going to get problems. So it's, you know, and there's certain risks from over-exercising, especially if you're not going to eat right.
Yeah, I think that's, it probably is giving, you know, more of the endurance world a bad name, and mainly because the nutrition is so poor in a lot of people. And, of course, the paleo craze, if anything, is infiltrating it. So they're eating more and more high-fat stuff, and even some of the recommendations are to, you know, like train with butter and train with all this, you know, high saturated fat stuff, because they think if you eat fat, you'll burn fat. I don't know where this is, you know, I don't know where the idea this is coming from.
It's crazy. It's really just crazy the way nutrition has become like influenced by personal food preference and politics, where people can twist the science and try to, like, you know, accept only that narrow realm of science they want to accept, disallowing all the other evidence so they can do, you know, so there's just so much footballing back and forth between craziness in the nutritional field. Can you imagine that? People thinking that butter now is healthy? That's like, wow, you know, it's like they're so mixed up. It's sad, you know. What can you do? You can't, you know, at some point you got to say, you know, we can't help everybody, but there's a lot of people out there that do want to be helped, and we got to do the best job we can and feel good about the effort we put in. But unfortunately, we can't reach everybody with, you know.
No, I think it's sad, though, when it comes, you know, when, you know, college athletics, and you know, a lot of these athletes, the drink milk campaigns and all this kind of stuff, that, you know, and it's basically sponsorship, bacon protein bars and all this kind of stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Well, so you just finished your immersion weekends. Can we go to your website to find out your next set of weekends, or how?
I do. I travel around the country. I do certain weekend events. I do have a week event coming up in July 6th in Newport Beach, California. You know, we do a big getaway each year. Mm-hmm. It's really fun for people to vacate with like-minded people and to learn this information in a setting like that, where they're learning, getting all the food made for them and learning the recipes, now showing how great it can taste. So, yeah, I have, you know, the people can go to the events portion of the website and see where my next event is. It's great to come to a live event sometimes, and maybe I'll come down, invite me, we'll work something out. Maybe I'll come down to your area and put on some event together or something.
I would love that. That would be fantastic. I'm trying to actually get a day-long event, you know, going, or, you know, maybe a weekend. We're in a little, you know, it's on the West Coast, so there's things for people to do, paddleboarding, you know, kayaking and things like that.
Where do you live again?
It's about 40 minutes south of Sarasota, Florida.
Oh.
Tampa, south of, west coast of Florida.
You know, hold on, I'm going to be down there a little bit. Hold on, let me tell you my schedule real quick. I'm going to be in Fort Myers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's right next door to me. It's like 30 minutes away. When is that?
Tuesday, I'm speaking to the hospital in Lee Memorial Hospital to the doctors at 7:30 in the morning. At 12 noon, I'm speaking at the Heights Center, which is a Healthy to 100 anti-cancer science, to the public. And I have another at the Westin at the Grand Ballroom. I'm speaking at 5:30 that night. So I have three lectures on Tuesday, 5:19. And then I have a day before. That's on Tuesday. On Monday, I have a lecture at the Y, I think, at the Naples YMCA at 2 to 3 o'clock, I have a lecture. So on Monday the 18th and Tuesday the 19th, I'll be in that area. You know, I'll post it on the website, I guess. Let me see if it's on my website now. I don't know if it's not up there yet, but, I don't think let's see. Newport Beach. No, I don't have a. I'll make it so I'll get it something up there about the Fort Myers events where I'm going to be in that area.
Yeah, fantastic.
I might be good if we could meet.
Yeah, I'd love to track you down on the 19th. That would be great.
Okay, good. So it's run through the Lee Memorial Hospital, so I'm sure they'll have information about it. You know?
Okay, cool. Yes, I'll crash the event to meet you.
Great.
They can only, you see the policeman dragging somebody out, you know, with the carrot in their hand. It'll be me, you know. All right. Well, fantastic. I do so much appreciate your time. Your books are fantastic. You know, the nutrient dense concept is something that we all need, and it's so simple to understand, and you drive it home, and you know, everything's laid out very, very well in your books. And like I said, I'm going to use some of your techniques in my wellness class, and certainly give you credit for it and put your books out there, and we'll go from there.
Terrific. Great to talk to you, and good luck with your personal life, and certainly with your effect on the people you're in contact with and your patients. Wonderful thing to know. Wonderful to know about a doctor like you who cares about their patients so much.
Thank you so much for all your good work. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
So fortunate to have Dr. Furman lend us some time to speak about his nutrient-dense diet, the nutritarian plan, as he puts it. You know, he does bring up some very good points. His nutritarian method favors plants, vegetables, whole grains, but less of grains, more of fruits and vegetables, and nuts and seeds. And he worries about some of the, obviously, as all of the plant-based plans do, white processed flours. So I think one point to recognize is that processed flours, no matter what kind of grain they come from, when you process things, they're much more easily absorbed and they lose so many nutrients. So whether it's millet or wheat berries or whatever kind of grain that you process into flour, by making it so small, it's much more easily absorbed and can cause insulin spikes and cause problems. And I also, you know, do believe that people that are diabetic, these simple flours cause problems. On the other hand, he does believe in nuts and seeds, and certainly they provide an excellent source of omega-3 fatty acids. So walnuts, hemp seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, excellent source of omega-3 fatty acids. So he wants you to get at least an ounce of that a day. If people don't have weight problems, in males especially, that, you know, that are larger, you know, you can take up to 3 ounces a day. But he recommends that more in the dressings for salads or toppings for salads or toppings for your breakfast, not just to sit around and eat handfuls of nuts as a snack. Your food should come from your meals, which are multicolored vegetables, zucchini, beans, legumes, peppers, onions, mushrooms, you know, the benefits of the G-bombs, which are greens, you know, of any kind, the kale, Swiss chard, beets, beet tops, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, and then bombs being berries, everyday onions, mushrooms, the study that he referred to decreasing the risk of breast cancer with mushrooms, and beans, legumes, and seeds, meaning pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, flax seeds. So, you know, I think the nutritarian way of thinking about things is excellent. We want to take time to think about what we're eating, and I think so much of the time we don't. You know, if you drive into a fast food line, you're not thinking about the ingredients of a meal. Oftentimes, when you go to a restaurant, you're not thinking about the actual nutrients of a meal. You get sucked into, you know, what appeals to your taste buds or what you think might be good. And then even a lot of times after that, I know my mother, she'll go out with her friend and, you know, they'll splurge a little bit. And she's like, oh, I thought I wanted this. And so I kind of snuck and got it, but it didn't taste good. And now I don't feel good. So try to be conscious of the nutrient content of your food or the nutrient content of the selections of your food before you order them or before you start to cook them, and actually be conscious of what you're eating. And I think that'll lead to much better choices. Like he said, read as much as you can. You know, I've presented several people now, and there's a little bit of varying of opinion, especially when it comes to a few starchy vegetables, but it's minuscule. You know, where the white potato falls into things, you know, it depends on who you are. And, you know, your glycemic index can be affected by yourself and how you metabolize, how you produce, and how much insulin you produce, where your stages of diabetes, how overweight you are, in what context do you eat that white potato. So I think that you can get, you know, with the white potato, it may be a little bit more of a debatable issue. But when it comes to white milled flours, everybody's on the same side. You know, leave them alone. If you're going to eat bread, do the sprouted grains. But again, try to make those minimal. Try to make whole plants and fruits, you know, more of your selection. You know, other than that, you know, the whole foods, not processed, not pressed oils, you know, it's the same thing keeps coming back over and over. So I think it's important to take that away. You know, certainly in my next class, I'm going to try, you know, some menu. We have 16 people in the class, so I think we'll make menus for the next 2 weeks together so that everybody can participate and everybody can take ownership of what they're eating and what they're going to shop for. I think that, you know, planning is huge in, you know, not only selecting what you're going to eat, be conscious of what you're going to eat, and then plan your meals out, when you're going to cook them, if you're going to store some up, freeze some, or have some meals made. You know, I always try to have beans on hand already made in the pressure cooker, maybe make rice for the week. I'll do some of my morning energy bars, have them made in advance. So those are all good things to kind of have your prep done in advance. Have your fruits available. If you have pineapple, get it all chopped up in a bag so you can just grab it. I know if I have a pineapple sitting on the counter, I'll sit and stare at it for days because I really don't want to get into the mess. But, you know, it's so good once you have it all chopped up. And again, don't forget, it's summertime. Chop the top off the pineapple and just stick it in the ground. It'll grow into a new pineapple. And it's a nice looking plant. So save your pineapple tops. Follow up for myself. My garden's doing well. I have zucchini starting to come on the vine. I have a few little cucumbers starting to come on the vine. I have two potato plants that popped up, so I'm awful excited. My greens are still doing well. I have a watermelon plant that's doing well, so hopefully I'll have watermelons. It might not be till Christmas, but they're growing, so I'm content. I planted my black sapota tree and my mulberry tree, and so hopefully they'll do well. My papaya tree and my pomegranate trees are doing well. As far as my endurance athletics, not so well. I'm still suffering from some sciatica from where I fell on my back with Samantha when we were running, but I'm able to cycle. My wrist is healing, so I'm able to do a lot of core exercises, so that's always needed. So I'm going to take the good from that and do as many core exercises as I can, do the bike, and start to swim when I can. I overdid one swimming with too much kicking and kind of set my back back, but, you know, it'll all work out. So I look forward to a summer of fun training. I got out on the bike last weekend, so hopefully get out more. Hope to have some more good interviews in the near future. And until then, eat your plants, eat your whole foods, be conscious of what you're eating, and run long. Good night.